Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 21st of May, these are our main stories. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reacted furiously after the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor said he was seeking his arrest for alleged crimes in the Gaza war alongside leaders of Hamas. Here in the UK, an inquiry has concluded there was a chilling cover-up of Britain's biggest health disaster in which 30,000 people were infected with contaminated blood products.
The NHS and successive governments compounded the agony by refusing to accept that wrong had been done.
Also in this podcast, in New Caledonia, the airport is closed and blockades continue after violence spreads in the French overseas territory after a French law to expand voting rights. And we'll hear what could be the sound of summer. Condemnation of the International Criminal Court from Israel and Israel's allies has come thick and fast following its prosecutor Karim Khan's request for the arrest warrants against the Israeli Prime Minister and the Defence Minister over alleged war crimes committed in Gaza. As you heard in our earlier podcast, the ICC is also seeking arrest warrants for three Hamas leaders who are accused of being criminally responsible for the killing of more than 1,000 civilians on the 7th of October. Our correspondent Anna Holligan is at The Hague, where the ICC sits.
I should say these allegations are devastating on both sides. And Karim Khan says that the acts committed, he says, by Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister, and Yoav Gallant, Defence Minister, aren't happening by accident, but by design, part of a systematic common plan designed to starve and kill Gaza's civilian population as a means to, one, eliminate Hamas, two, secure the return of hostages, and three, collectively punish the civilian population of Gaza. And then on the other side, in terms of the allegations against the Hamas leadership, he said that they were instrumental in instigating and planning the October 7th attacks, and then just goes through some of the statements made by the witnesses, by the survivors, and says that now is the time. He said in a statement he warned that those who ignored him couldn't complain later, and he said this: the time is now. The other thing to watch here is the diplomatic efforts on both sides to try to prevent any future arrest warrants from actually being served. And it's a very contentious issue because the ICC, any country that is a member of the ICC, is obliged to arrest anyone who is subject to an ICC arrest warrant. But we expect some objections to that rule. In the coming days, we will hear more from countries objecting, as we have done today.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reacted angrily to the court's decision.
The outrageous decision by the ICC prosecutor, Karim Khan, to seek arrest warrants against the democratically elected leaders of Israel is a moral outrage of historic proportions. It will cast an everlasting mark of shame on the international court. Israel is waging a just war against Hamas, a genocidal terrorist organization that perpetrated the worst attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust.
The US President Joe Biden echoed Mr. Netanyahu's comments and called the move outrageous. Both the UK and Israel have said the ICC's decision will make it more difficult to achieve a ceasefire in Gaza and safeguard the return of hostages. Even one of Benjamin Netanyahu's most trenchant critics, the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, disagreed with the court's decision. He's been talking to my colleague Tim Franks.
Quite frankly, I think that we probably may have made some mistakes during these last 7 months, but there is nothing near to what the prosecutor is suggesting. And particularly, I think the fact that he binds together the murderer and the terrorist, Yihyeh Sinwar, and Mohammed Deif, who has been responsible over the years for unlimited number of the most terrible terrorist actions against innocent civilians, is totally unacceptable by most Israelis, including all those that are opposed to Netanyahu.
But the prosecutor was very clear that he is not passing any judgment on Israel's right to self-defense or about the reasons for the conflict. It is about the way in which the war has been waged, the way it has been prosecuted. But it is not a judgment on Israel's right to wage the war itself.
They didn't have to wait 7 months in order to prosecute Yihyeh Sinwar and Mohammed Deif. The atrocious activities of Hamas were known from October 7th. So why did they have to wait 7 months in order to bind them together with the Prime Minister of Israel? I mean, this is something that smells not fair and not honest.
When you heard the Defense Minister Yoav Gallant just after October the 7th ordering a complete siege of the Gaza Strip, there will be no electricity, no food, no fuel, everything is closed. Were you worried then that that might be construed as being against the laws of war?
I think the laws of war defend not to statements, but to actions. If there is a firm evidence that Israel has committed, as a matter of policy, in purpose, war crimes or crimes against humanity, this is something that will have to be clarified, and I'm sure that we have a very good answers for this, because I don't think that this is the policy of Israel. I'm not talking about possible mistakes which were committed.
The former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert with Tim Franks. We know the request for arrest warrants from the prosecutor at the ICC is just that, a request. Judges at the International Criminal Court will now decide whether prosecutions will actually go ahead. So how likely is that? Sean Lay has been talking to Ryan Goodman, a professor of law at NYU School of Law in New York.
Extremely high, to the point that one has to search for instances in which the pretrial chamber would reject the application for an arrest warrant. I do know of one case, but even in that case, the prosecutor then resubmitted the application and got it approved. It's a record of something like 99%, but it's not completely out of the question, especially with a long list of crimes like this, that some of them might be taken off.
We heard about Israel saying it will fight this diplomatically. Is that possible, given that this is a court?
It's very difficult, very, very difficult. This really is a court of law. These are charges that are going to be reviewed by judges. The one thing that I think is important as a matter of perspective is that it's a long, drawn-out process.
Can Israel say, well, look, this doesn't apply to us, we're not members of the ICC?
That argument doesn't work. The United States recently gave up that argument when it applied to the question of Russian forces inside Ukraine, because Russia is not a party to the ICC either, but the United States now says, of course, the ICC has jurisdiction over Russia. The other argument is to try to argue that Palestine is not a state for the purposes of the ICC statute. That has been already decided by a pretrial chamber of the court, but they did say, look, we can revisit this question in later proceedings.
What about the how this relates to the International Court of Justice hearing, which is going on at the moment, which has been brought by South Africa?
So today's application does not include the offense of genocide. And the South Africa proceedings are a claim of genocide. There is another legal claim that the prosecutor is making, and he is saying that Israel is and has engaged in a crime against humanity, including persecution. Now, that's different than genocide. Genocide is a very hard crime to prove because it comes with an additional element. The additional element is that the perpetrators have to be acting with a specific purpose to try to destroy the group or whole and in part.
Could this affect the conduct of the war now? In particular, I suppose, the behavior of Israel's allies?
Yes, I do think that governments that support Israel will have to do a legal analysis and consider, for example, if indeed there are war crimes being committed, then there could be legal liability and a legal prohibition on states supporting Israel with arms, supplies, and the like. In fact, under international criminal law, there's another element to this, which is that there's liability for aiding and abetting another in the commission of war crimes. So I think they're going to have to look at that hard as to where they stand.
Professor Ryan Goodman, Professor of Law at NYU School of Law in New York. South Africa's Constitutional Court has ruled that the former president, Jacob Zuma, is not eligible to run for parliament in next week's election. Mr. Zuma, who was forced to quit as president in 2018, has fallen out with the governing ANC and has been campaigning instead in support of his new MK party. From Johannesburg, here's Anne Soy.
The court said that as per the constitution, having been convicted for a sentence that was longer than 12 months, he is therefore ineligible to run for office for at least a period of 5 years. However, he had argued that he only served 3 months of the 15-month sentence that was handed to him in 2021 for contempt of court. That was after he failed to appear before an inquiry into corruption allegations that he was facing at the time during his tenure as a president. And he argued that he served this for only 3 months, but the court held that he had been sentenced to a sentence that was longer than 12 months and therefore that disqualified him.
Next to Iran. And sounds from central Tehran as crowds of people, many holding pictures of President Ebrahim Raisi, chanting their support for Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei after the death of the president in a helicopter crash. This was the view of one woman in Iran who wanted to remain anonymous.
I feel this collective happiness is what we deserve. After all the suffering we went through as a nation, listening to bad news, death news, mourning, when I think about how they treated us, how they oppressed us, this news gives me hope. I hope this is the beginning of the end of their dictatorship.
Farishta Sar-Eghi is a journalist in Tehran.
The mood is somehow sober. The streets are somehow quiet. I saw two men. They were talking with each other. I just heard that they were discussing the chopper crash. When I was walking, I saw a middle-aged lady. She was a religious one. And suddenly she broke into crying. She was very sad. She was crying. And then she was saying that I worry about the country. Nobody officially or openly tries to show any mood of happiness.
Funeral rites for Ebrahim Raisi and the other people who died will begin later. 5 days of mourning are being held. An investigation into the crash has been ordered. And the election to find Mr. Raisi's replacement will be on June the 28th. Baron Abbasi from BBC Persian is following developments.
We have seen pictures of people mourning for his death, including some state-organized gatherings in large squares inside of Iran, where people have been holding up President Raisi's pictures and expressing sadness for his death. But he was a very divisive figure. He was by no means popular among the whole Iranian nation, and those who were shown on state TV are not the representatives of the majority of Iranians.
So that's one group of people. I mean, it's a hardline Iranian regime. He was a significant part of it. There might be all sorts of groups of people who are thinking, is this some hope for a more liberal future, who might have mixed feelings about Raisi's death?
Exactly. A lot of people took to Twitter, and the sources that we talked to in Iran, they were not shedding any tears for the president, and some were even expressing happiness for his death, because he was a hardline figure who was elected as president in 2021 in elections that saw the lowest turnout in the history of the Islamic Republic. And elections in Iran are not like elections in democratic countries. And his presidency was overshadowed by mass protests in 2022 that were sparked by the death in custody of Mahsa Amini and the brutal crackdown that followed. Hundreds of people were killed.
And the people who are celebrating or expressing some degree of pleasure that Raisi has died, are they just feeling some kind of sense of avenging what's happened in the past? Or are they hopeful that things might change in any way now when there will be a new president?
It is very unlikely for things to change. Ebrahim Raisi although he was president, he did not have much power in terms of decision-making. He executed and carried out the orders of the supreme leader. It is expected that the new elections that will be held within the next 50 days, again, will be dominated by hardliners, and someone close to the supreme leader will be allowed to run unelected, especially since the supreme leader is 85 years old. And it seems that he wants to make sure that those who are holding the power and they're holding the keys of to the most important parts of the establishment are those who are the most loyal to himself.
Baron Abbasi of BBC Persian. And still to come in this podcast,
the places where we used to go to fish have now mostly become islands, and there is no water. We can't go by boat. If there is no water, there is no fish.
The Caspian Sea in Central Asia, the world's largest inland body of water, is shrinking.
Press freedom. The reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, the country knows and the world knows there was a deliberate attempt to lie and conceal. Those the words of one campaigner responding to the publication of the final report of the UK's Infected Blood Inquiry. It relates to Britain's biggest health disaster, in which 30,000 people were infected with contaminated blood products between the 1970s and 90s. The inquiry concluded there was a subtle, pervasive and chilling cover-up of the infected blood scandal. Its chairman was Sir Brian Langstaff.
The NHS and successive governments compounded the agony by refusing to accept that wrong had been done. More than that, the government repeatedly maintained that people received the best available treatment and that testing of blood donations began as soon as the technology was available. And both claims were untrue.
Much of the blood came from the United States, where donors were paid. It was often collected in prisons. There have been 3,000 deaths linked to contaminated blood so far, and thousands more have debilitating conditions. Andy Evans, who has haemophilia, was given contaminated blood as a child. By the time he was 13, he had AIDS.
We've been gaslit for generations. This report today brings an end to that, and it looks to the future as well, and says that this cannot continue, this ethos of denial and cover-up.
Susan Lee found out she'd been infected with hepatitis C when she was 14.
There was no acknowledgement that, you know, these treatments were being given that had these risks of hepatitis and HIV. And, you know, how can any parent walk into any facility now and have confidence in the treatment that their children are given?
The victims have been calling for an apology, and they got one from the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak.
Today's report shows a decades-long moral failure at the heart of our national life. From the National Health Service to the Civil Service, to ministers in successive governments, at every level, the people and institutions in which we place our trust failed in the most harrowing and devastating way.
Our science correspondent Kate Lamball told me more about the findings of the inquiry.
This public inquiry spent more than 5 years looking at these 30,000 infections of HIV and hepatitis, and it found that they largely, if not entirely, could and should have been avoided. When we're talking about this cover-up, we don't necessarily, actually, the person in charge of the inquiry said they preferred hiding the truth. And they're saying that because they're not saying this is a movie with someone in charge deciding what's seen and what's not. It's partly the passage of time that documents were lost. But it is true that they found today that some documents were deliberately destroyed, and that over time, politicians have used inaccurate, misleading and defensive lines to take time over this.
The blood that infected so many people, where was it from?
Yeah, so it's a mix of things. So part of it is these blood products. It's clotting factors used to treat people with blood clotting disorders like haemophilia. And a lot of it was imported from the United States. And that's where it was made by pooling together plasma from tens of thousands of people. And just one infected person feeding into that pool could infect the entire batch.
In terms of what happens now, in many ways, this is the end point that people have been campaigning for decades have wanted. Next, we get some compensation. The British Prime Minister was pretty clear about that.
Yeah, they said that the details of that should be announced tomorrow. And you talk about time there. I think what's so interesting is the different responses, because this problem isn't unique to the UK. Other countries like Japan, France and the US, they all saw these problems. But a lot of it was settled in the 90s, 1996, 1997. And it's taken this length of time for compensation to be brought here. But then there's also the reaction to these recommendations for further change within the UK system that's been made.
Our correspondent Kate Lamble with me. The Caspian Sea in Central Asia is the world's largest inland body of water, and it's shrinking at an unprecedented speed. It's the size of Germany. It's bordered by five countries: Kazakhstan, Russia, Iran, Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. Antonia Bolingbroke-Kent has been to Kazakhstan, formerly part of the Soviet Union, to find out why the Caspian Sea is in crisis.
I'm just climbing up some wooden steps onto this old pier. The bottom few steps are missing because, well, it's not really a pier anymore because it's nowhere near the sea. Azamat, do you remember when this pier was in the sea, as it should be?
Well, we were here in around 2006, 2008. There'd been newlyweds and other young people. You'd see lots of people sitting here and walking along the pier.
Azamat Sarsenbaev is a well-known social media influencer from the Kazakh port city of Aktau. He posts about environmental issues, particularly what's happening to the Caspian Sea.
It was a very popular place, and from here we'd stand on the railings and jump into the water.
Azamat's saying that as a teenager he used to stand on this pier and dive into the clear blue waters of the Caspian Sea. From where I'm standing at the end of this old wooden pier, it's at least 70 metres to where the waves are breaking along the shoreline. The sea has receded that far in less than 20 years. There are very few scientists in Kazakhstan who are studying the Caspian Sea. One is Asel Tazmagombietova, the daughter of a former Kazakh prime minister who set up the Central Asian Institute for Ecological Research. She believes climate change is playing a major role in the shallowing of the sea, which has fallen by around 4 metres since the year 2000. Plus, there's the issue of the Russian rivers that feed the Caspian.
The inflow of rivers into the Caspian Sea, especially the Volga River, has diminished over time. Extensive dam construction on the Volga River, initiated during Soviet industrialization, also greatly reduced water flow into the sea.
She also mentions the impact of the offshore oil and gas industry on the seabed.
The removal of large volumes of oil and natural gas from beneath the seafloor can cause compaction of the seabed, potentially affecting water depths.
We put this to Kazakhstan's Ministry of Energy, but they didn't respond. We also contacted Russia's Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment regarding the Volga. They didn't reply either. Dania Akimzhanov is head of the regional fishing association based in Bautino, further up the coast. He describes how the shallowing of the Caspian Sea is making things much harder for fishermen here.
The places where we used to go to fish have now mostly become islands, and there is no water. We can't go by boat. If there is no water, there is no fish.
Aktau relies almost entirely on desalinated water. And the more the Caspian shallows, the more precarious this supply becomes. There are problems at Aktau port, too. Oil tankers crossing to Baku in Azerbaijan now can't be fully loaded because of falling water levels. German and Dutch scientists predict that the Caspian Sea could fall by a further 18 metres by the end of this century, which really worries Asel Tazmagombietova from the Central Asian Institute for Ecological Research.
I think it's a very serious problem. It's very sad because we're losing time. I guess we have to prepare the region for these big changes.
And to hear more about the Caspian crisis, go to bbcworldservice.com/assignment or look for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Here in the UK, the High Court has temporarily blocked the extradition to the United States of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. He's been given permission to bring a new appeal. The US want him to stand trial for leaking military secrets, which prosecutors say endanger lives. He wants assurances that he'd be able to rely on the US constitutional right to free speech as a defence. Mr. Assange, who's currently in Belmarsh prison, will now prepare his appeal argument about whether he'll be given a fair trial in the US. This from our legal correspondent, Dominic Kashani.
Today's decision is a legal lifeline for Julian Assange after a five-year-long fight that began when Donald Trump's administration demanded he be put on trial over events 14 years ago. In March, judges said US prosecutors must provide clearer assurances about how the Australian would be treated. Mr. Assange now has a guarantee from the US that he will never face the death penalty over the WikiLeaks saga, but his lawyers say he may still be denied the right to argue in a trial that his leaks were legitimate journalism protected by US free speech laws. The High Court says that question must now be fully explored at a full appeal hearing. Speaking outside court, Mr. Assange's wife, Stella, urged President Biden to abandon the prosecution.
How long can this go on? The United States should read the situation and drop this case now. Yeah. Now is the moment to do it. Yeah. Just abandon this shameful attack on journalists, on the press, and the public that has been going on for 14 years.
For weeks, there's been speculation that President Biden wants to end the affair after he confirmed he was considering an Australian government plan relating to dropping the prosecution. This new appeal will take months to prepare, giving his administration time to consider their options in this extraordinary legal drama.
At a military airbase in France, the Interior Minister and French military police have honoured the bodies of two gendarmes who died in the unrest in New Caledonia. Follows a week of violent protests in the French territory in the South Pacific against a decision to reform voting laws. The French President Emmanuel Macron is meeting his Security Council to discuss the crisis. They've already sent 1,000 police reinforcements. The main airport in New Caledonia has been closed to commercial flights. Australia is awaiting French permission to evacuate its citizens, as is New Zealand's Prime Minister Christopher Luxon.
What we have done is made sure that we are ready with a number of plans and scenarios, and what we need to wait for is the French authorities to say those roads are safe, the airport's safe and secure, in order for that transportation of Kiwis to be able to get to the airport, for example. We've got to wait for that advice. We are having ongoing conversations with the French authorities in Paris and also in Noumea. We'll continue to do so, but the key thing is that we are ready to go.
My colleague Bernadette Keogh asked our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard what led up to the violence.
You need to have a little bit of context of the history of New Caledonia. First of all, New Caledonia, it's an archipelago. It's about 1,300 kilometres off the eastern coast of Australia, roughly equidistant between Papua New Guinea and New Zealand. Now, it was taken by France in the mid-19th century. And there have been, ever since then, problems and clashes with the indigenous Kanak community, the indigenous Melanesian community there. Nowadays, the Kanak community makes up about 40% of the population, about 300,000 people there. And the pro-independence supporters amongst the Kanak indigenous community are very upset about a new law in France that's been pushed through. Basically, it would expand the voting rights for people who've settled in New Caledonia and had their main residence there for at least 10 years. Up to now, the people who voted in New Caledonia have had to live there since 1998. That was a time where an agreement was reached on a transition towards more autonomy, greater independence there. And it also scheduled several votes on independence. Those are all, well, two were marginally rejected and the third one didn't happen because of COVID. So there's a background to this of pro-independence support amongst a chunk of the population of New Caledonia.
And the island is a French territory. How big a problem
problem is this for Emmanuel Macron?
Well, it's enough for him to have called a meeting of his National Security Council. There's a nighttime curfew in the territory at the moment. There's also things like a ban on TikTok because the French fear that there's agitation in favour of more rioting. And obviously, there's a wider backdrop to this. So Emmanuel Macron is only a few weeks away from European elections, parliamentary elections, and it's not a good look for him in terms of security and law and order.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard. Now, if you're looking for the sound of summer, one contender this year could be a drum and bass tune called The Spark. Rather than coming from a big studio in LA, this one comes from Cork in Ireland, and the artists behind it are all under 12. Here's Isabella Jewell.
It's loud, high energy, and it's lit up the internet. This is The Spark, a song created by a group of more than 30 Irish and refugee children. They're all between 9 and 12 years old and have shot to social media fame after their wild music video was viewed more than 8 million times. The Spark was made at Cabin Studio, which was commissioned to create an anthem for an Irish National Youth Arts Day. A team of musicians there host a weekly rap project to teach kids about songwriting and recording. Gary McCarthy is the studio's creative director.
It's all about capturing the kids' energy. We're really, really lucky to work with a really talented group of kids who are just like naturally funny, they're gifted, they're great energy, they're always up for a challenge, and anytime they go on stage, they absolutely smash it.
The Irish kids collaborated with children at a refugee centre in nearby County Clare to write the song. Both groups met in Cork to record the track and make the music video before sharing it online. And the response exceeded all expectations.
We filmed the video all in one day. It started off at the Cabin Studio, and we got everyone onto the local 202 bus into the city centre, got some shots on top of the bus. I had a feeling that a couple of thousand people might see it or something like that, that it would just go a little bit locally viral or nationally viral, but I was not expecting how crazy it went on X.
Indeed, US-based news site Irish Central called it the song of the summer. Dylan is one of the young artists behind the track.
It was really exciting because like it felt like I was doing something really professional. I had a verse. That's my passion and I couldn't live without it. You can do it like we do it, don't doubt it. Any obstacle, we find a way around it. If you're proud of who you are and what you do, shout it!
Gary McCarthy.
Is it going to be the sound of the summer? I'm not sure. Our main focus is the young people and continuing to help them with their songwriting, their recording. And if it happens to be the sound of the summer, then that's a bonus.
Isabella Jewell reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or on X, we are @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Marion Straw. And the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Press freedom. The reasons why it's under increasing pressure.
How the mass use of drones has changed the way the war is being fought.
The trends behind the fast-changing media landscape.
The explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.